And perhaps never is the emotion so great as when a gold medal is presented only to be stripped away because an athlete has failed a drugs test or some other event has meant that they didn't actually deserve that gold medal. R.T. Kendall, in his commentary on this chapter of 2 Samuel 3, notes that we have two characters who were both striving for gold, but both missed out for various reasons. We have Abner, who had been the commander of Saul's army, and Joab, the commander of David's army. Both men had achieved greatness, in a sense, in reaching their positions. But in what could have been their greatest hour, they both fell short. If Abner had only acknowledged David to be the rightful next king, he could have been a hero, bringing the hearts of the army and the people in general under David's leadership. Instead, he tried to set up in opposition, and only when that plan was clearly not working and failing did he then try and do what he should have done in the first place. His timing and his priorities were all wrong, and so he missed out on the gold. Likewise, Joab. He was a man in a great position. He could also have been a hero if only he'd allowed God's timing to be worked out. If he'd followed David's command, waited on God's timing, but it seems that he was acting upon his own authority and trying to see things done according to his own timescale. The end of verse 26 that we read makes it clear that David did not know about Joab's plan to bring Abner back to Hebron, but that Joab was acting according to his own authority. And it's quite possible that this was not the first occasion. We could turn back to a couple of chapters previously and see the time when the two armies met together. And at first reading, you think it's David and his men, and it's Ishbosheth and his men. But then you read it again and you realize that actually David and Ishbosheth weren't mentioned as being there at all, and it seems to just be their armies and these generals or commanders. Now it's reckoned that Abner had pretty much set himself up as the power, and that Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was basically a puppet king. He was just there by name. But Joab, it seems, had almost followed his example in acting upon his own authority and claiming to be in power. He was a little bit too big for his boots, we might say, in our own day. And we could see that if we were to read on through the book of 2 Samuel. And without the position to rightfully wield such powers, he simply succeeded in spoiling his record. Really, he thought Abner was getting away with too much. Did you ever feel like that? You look at people around you and you think, they shouldn't be allowed to get away with that. God should be punishing them. They should be sorted out. You kind of want to see justice now. Joab perhaps felt like that, and so he acted as he felt right in his own eyes. Taking the law into his own hands, he brought Abner back and had him put to death. David had been unaware of Joab's specific intentions and the following plans, and so he had to wait on the news finally arriving as it reached him. That's why we see in verse 28, it begins with the words later or afterwards. David was obviously devastated. He immediately proclaimed that this had not been his desire or intention for Abner, and that the blame fell squarely on the shoulders of Joab. Therefore, David declared himself free of debt. He made a sort of deal for freedom. He was speaking out his innocence. I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord, he said, for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. David wanted to state his innocence right from the outset of investigations. Not only his personal innocence, but the innocence of his kingdom. Joab had acted on his own authority, not on the wishes or command of either king or country. And David wanted that to be known. May the guilt fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, David continued in verse 29. Not only clearing his own name, but making that absolutely clear where the blame lay. As a result, David almost interceded on behalf of Abner's family, asking, may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a crutch, or one who falls by the sword, or lacks bread. David perhaps recalled the time when Miriam questioned the authority of Moses, and how as a result she became leprous. We could find that the same outcome would result with Uzziah, the king who tried to act as high priest and rebelled against the high priest, and how leprosy broke out on him as well. There may have been the desire to stop the endless tit for tat and judgment and acts of violence coming, and revenge attacks one family on the other. But for justice to be seen to be done, David therefore asked for a very obvious physical defect or difficulty to be evident in Joab's family for generations to come, as a reminder of his offence here in the murder of Abner. Some commentators say that Joab should have been put to death for this act of murder. For various reasons, we see that David did not act personally at this time, but simply allowed God to bring about the judgment in his time. The guilt was upon the family, not just upon Joab. Perhaps because, as verse 30 seems to indicate, Abishai, Joab's brother, assisted him in some way, or at the very least allowed the murder to take place. The record in verse 30 holds Abishai almost as guilty as Joab, attributing Abner's death to both of them. And in verses 31 to 35 we see David's expression of sorrow and anguish. The focus of at least some of the sorrow is found in David's song of lament in verses 34 and 35. And there he speaks of the death of a fool. That statement, it almost seems at first to be rather cruel, perhaps insensitive. But I believe with a little more understanding of what David saw, we can realise that it really does emphasise his sorrow and despair. It all hinges, I believe, on where Abner was killed, the situation surrounding him, so the situation of the particular city where they were. Hebron was the city where David was ruling from. And Hebron was one of the cities designated as a city of refuge. There had been three cities designated on either side of the River Jordan, spread out equally so that a city was always in reach, no matter where people were within the kingdom. The law at that time, of course, stated that if you killed someone, then the family would be justified in tracking you down and taking avenging that blood. Taking the life of the murderer would purge the land of innocent blood. But the law was not so blind as to think that any instance of someone being killed would be a deliberate murder. And so it sought to provide a means of escape. We see in Deuteronomy 19, an example was given of someone working in the forest, swinging an axe, and the head of the axe flying off and hitting someone and taking their life. Obviously, it was an accidental act. The one whose axe head had killed a man could in that instance flee to a city of refuge where he would be judged by the congregation. And if the verdict was found to have been an accidental death, then the man would have been granted protection until the death of the high priest. A city of refuge, a place of safety, of security. Such protection, though, was only on offer as long as the person stayed within the city. Again, instruction was given in Numbers 35 that if the person was found outside of the city, that refuge was no longer available. How does all this ancient history, though, you might ask, affect the situation here in 2 Samuel? Well, if we were to look back to chapter 2 and see there the murder of Asahel, it could be argued that Abner had not intended to kill him, but simply to temporarily immobilize him so as to be able to get away. It was a case of self-defense. It was an act during wartime. Abner could therefore have been considered someone who could seek refuge in a city of refuge. One of these cities was Hebron, where David was residing as king, the southern territory. This was the place where Abner was requested or perhaps demanded to come back to by Joab. Unfortunately, though, we see Abner never made it to the city, but was killed by Joab at the gate. That perhaps gives a little more sense of understanding to David's statement. Why should Abner die, as it were, as a fool? Just a few more steps and he could have been in the city. He could have been safe. His life could have been protected. Now, of course, we could argue and question over whether the fact that whether Joab's thirst for revenge would have allowed him to adhere to the agreement. Some would argue that Joab's murder couldn't really be excused as either an act of war or as justifiable blood revenge. But David's point was that Abner really walked into a trap. He says, "Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered." Abner was free to go where he wished. When he saw Joab, perhaps with revenge in his eyes, he could have fled either into the city for refuge or run away completely. But it seems that he just wandered on in to the trap that had been set. This text, this thought of the city of refuge has been used in the proclamation of the gospel, and rightly so, I believe. It shows that it doesn't matter how close you are to the kingdom or how far away. If you're not inside, then your life is in danger. And we could speak about how foolish it would be for people to try and live, as it were, on the clean side of the broad road. Trying to live a good life, a religious life, but never knowing God's salvation. William MacDonald states that the thought might mean that Abner had not died as an inexperienced fool who was unable to defend himself, but rather as a result of a deceitful, wicked plot. To all intents and purposes, however, Abner had died as a fool. Because of the death and all the tragic circumstances surrounding it, David said to Joab in verse 31 and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes, put on sackcloth and mourn." This was to be a solemn occasion, and even Joab was compelled to join the mourners. Abner had not been a prisoner. He still had the possibility of making his own decisions. He could have got into the city of refuge, but he hadn't, and he had perhaps died as a result. David's sorrow continues as we see it in verse 33, which is expressed as the denial of food. Fasting was often associated with mourning, of course, in the Old Testament, and so here, when the people came to persuade David to eat bread, David declared with an oath that he would neither eat nor drink anything before the sun went down. David in many ways demonstrated amazing grace, even the grace of God here, as he mourned the loss and spoke well of the one who had supported Saul as Saul had chased down his life, and the one who then had set up in opposition and caused great heartache for David and his kingdom. David obviously had some assurance that Abner had changed, that he really was going to bring the support of the people to him so that he could reign over them. Joab, however, couldn't see past what had happened in the past. Sometimes we can be like that, can't we? someone hurts us, or someone offends someone that we know, and we can never get over it, we can never conceive the possibility that God may have changed their hearts over time. We need God's wisdom in knowing how to respond to all people at all times. This sorrow, I believe, of David was quite genuine. Having said that, we can see that this public mourning certainly helped in the, as it were, the public opinion polls. The NIV Study Bible says, David did everything possible to demonstrate his innocence to the people. And in this, he was successful. And so in verses 36 and 37, we see the delight of the followers. I don't believe he was electioneering here in his behaviour. But as verse 36 says, all the people took notice of it. It pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all of the people. Now that might have been an exaggeration, it might have been a generalization, but I believe it shows that public opinion had shifted, that people were beginning to recognize David to be the rightful king, that the efforts of the now late Abner had been effective. It's possible that, as MacArthur said, that David's sorrow over Abner's death was even more effective in uniting Israel than his words in his life. His murder, and sadly another murder in the next chapter, delayed events, but it seems that David was finally on the road to victory, to uniting the country and to ruling over all of it as God had declared he would. Verse 37 simply reaffirms that fact. All the people of Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. And then we have two verses kind of tagged on to the end, and it's almost, we almost read it as a footnote, as an add-on, as something that doesn't really matter. We could describe it as a declaration of frailty. Frailty isn't quite the word that describes it. But I believe, though tucked away in virtual insignificance at the end of the chapter, this, in many ways, was the whole point of the whole chapter. It highlights the problems that can occur when the king is not allowed to rule. The sons of Zeruiah, that was David's half-sister at least, perhaps full-sister, her sons, Joab, Abishai, Asahel, it seems they were to cause David problems time and time again. And here, they were really usurping the king's authority. They were making decisions and acting in ways which they really had no authority for. Because of this, David was almost left impotent, unable to know how to handle the situation. Therefore, in a sense, he was frail or feeble. The same thing can happen still today with us. When we try to take on the position of authority over our lives that only God should have, when we try to be our own God, when we try to be in control of our own lives, we usurp God's power and authority. David had the strong position of king, and yet he felt weak because of the actions of these men. He didn't feel able to publicly deal with the offenders at that time. We would discover that the time would come, but not for a while. David again asks that God would repay the evildoer according to his wickedness, that he would bring the appropriate justice, and that the righteous would be vindicated. That's the right response, isn't it? That we turn judgment over to the judge of all the earth. We recognize God to be that righteous judge. R.T. Kendall says that God is always for the underdog. And when others hurt us or treat us unjustly, whether or not we know it, we are close to the heart of God. Vindication is God's speciality. We don't have to fight to clear our name. God will work in the best way and at the best time. His timing is always perfect, even though it may not always be the timing that we would have chosen. This, I believe, is greatly illustrated in the life of Christ. Of course, we know his death was planned. We know it was all according to God's purpose, and yet still there's that sense that it was not fair. He had done nothing wrong. He didn't deserve to be put to death. But one day, we know he will be vindicated. John tells us in the book of Revelation that when Jesus comes again, every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. Justice will be done. R.T. Kendall says those who rejected Jesus will finally see that he is God's Son, and then they will face the final judgment. God commands all people everywhere to repent, we read in Acts 17, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness. We know that according to the Bible, judgment is coming. But praise God, we also know that salvation has been provided, that there is a place of refuge, a place of safety and security that we can flee to. Never be content, and never let anybody else be content with being almost all right, nearly saved, or just near the kingdom. Make sure of God's refuge. Be sure of God's salvation. Don't leave any chance of dying outside the kingdom. If we are following God, then be prepared to let him rule, to allow God to be God, to use his authority, to follow his leading. It's useless to try and act strong when really we are weak. Far better for us to acknowledge our weakness and to allow God to demonstrate his strength through us. For as Paul says, his strength is made perfect in our weakness.